Hey, it's Matt. A quick note before we get started today. This is a repeat of a show we aired last month, so we can't take your questions and comments like usual, but this was a particularly helpful show for anyone who's experiencing some heightened anxiety or symptoms of depression because of the pandemic. So we thought we'd bring it back for anyone who missed it. But even though we're not live today, we would still like to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show, and let us know what topics you want us to cover in an upcoming episode. We're on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about mental health. The pandemic has been a stressful time for most of us, to put it lightly. And a lot of people experiencing anxiety and depression might be feeling it for the first time. We're going to spend the hour talking to mental health experts about what these things feel like, why they happen to us, and what can be done to help. We have four guests with us. Edward Hertz is professor of psychological and brain sciences at Indiana University. Professor Hertz, welcome.
Thank you.
Jacek Kolacz is assistant research scientist at the Kinsey Institute Traumatic Stress Research Consortium at Indiana University. Jacek, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Beth Trammell is associate professor of psychology at Indiana University. Good afternoon, Beth.
Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone.
Katie Stanton-Nicholas is associate professor in the Department of Kinesiology at IUPUI. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Edward, we'll start with you. It probably feels obvious to anybody listening that a global pandemic is stressful and would produce anxiety in most people. But I want to break it down. Why does something like this cause anxiety?
Well, from my vantage point, the biggest thing that I think is so difficult in this particular situation is just the incredible uncertainty that we have, you know, just about almost any facet of life. You know, I mean, we had a sort of standard of, you know, sort of routines that we had, and we kind of knew how life operated, and to have all the upheaval that has happened associated with this that sort of changed the way we work, you know, what we can and can't do, how we should interact with people, et cetera. I mean, all those things are kind of up in the air, and we're getting conflicting information, and we're getting, a lot of changing kind of, you know, standards and norms of what we're supposed to follow. And I think that's just put people in a position where we just don't know what to do. And we're looking for guidance, and we're getting, again, a lot of different kind of information. And it really does create a sense of uncertainty. And under those situations, it's really hard for us to maintain a positive kind of outlook and to avoid feeling really, really anxious and depressed.
Can you talk about the kinds of people who are prone to anxiety? Some people have kind of enjoyed the isolation that the pandemic has brought about, but for others, it has hit them a little harder. How are people triggered into anxiety?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I think that we do see some people being able to cope with this much more effectively than others. And I think from our vantage point, one of the things that we see is that some people really do like things, have a preference for keeping things a certain way, having things according to orders and routines and stuff. And when those things are disrupted, it's very, very unsettling for them. One of the things in psychology we talk about is people having what they call a sort of a need for closure. And closure kind of means just the idea of, you know, you feel like things are predictable. You feel like things follow an order. Some of us are really okay with conflicting situations, with a lot of ambiguity, with having to look at things from multiple vantage points. Other people like things clear cut. We like things black and white. We like to know what to expect in situations. And so I think people for whom, you know, that is a prominent kind of concern for them, this situation has put them in a novel situation that they are uncomfortable with. Other people seem to be able to say, hey, this is a moment to step back, and I might be able to do things a little differently, and that, you know, again, have a different perspective on things, and maybe, you know, look at my life a little differently and make some different decisions and stuff. And so that may be something that isn't so troublesome for them.
Can you explain what we mean when we talk about anxiety? I mean, some people might think of it as just nervousness, but there's this wide spectrum of experiences people have with it, right?
Yeah, it definitely manifests itself differently in different people. But I think in general, this kind of feeling of not being able to to feel in control. I think that for most of us, we want to be able to feel in control of our situations, that we make our own decisions, that we know what's going to happen, and that sort of predictability and order to life is something that makes us feel comfortable and makes us feel a sense of predictability in life. And when that's disrupted, I think it really just creates this sort of nagging feeling of, I don't know what's going to happen. And I think for any of us that have been in novel situations where you don't know what to do, you don't know what's going to happen next and stuff, that unsettling kind of feeling that we have that permeates our experience in those situations until we get some guidance, until we know how to respond in that situation, is really, really unsettling. And I think for many people, it does manifest itself in a lot of kind of feelings. I mean, we have bouts of kind of anger and lashing out at situations where we just don't know how to respond in that situation. And I think that, again, it's just a fear and an apprehension and an amalgamation of a lot of different feelings.
So it's a broad spectrum, and it's a broad, there can be many levels of anxiety as well. Can you tell us what severe anxiety looks like?
Well, I think, some of the other panel members are probably better suited to be able to answer this than myself. But I just think that when people get to a severe level of anxiety, it is disruptive in the sense that we can't really act. I think it is almost an immobilizing kind of force that we think of people just not knowing what to do and being so unsettled that you can't really think rationally, that you're getting very emotional, that you kind of often do kind of shut down, and the intensity of those kind of feelings makes it difficult to be able to function effectively. And so, as we know, when people have to make quick decisions and have to be able to have their wits with them when somebody's feeling really anxious and unsettled, et cetera, they just can't function effectively. And it's really unsettling both for the person and people around them.
Professor Trammell, any follow-up on severe anxiety and maybe the scale of anxieties that we can notice in ourselves?
Yeah, I think Edward did a good job, and I think I often think about it in terms of impairment. So how impaired are you in the major domains of your life? So for adults, it would be at home, at work, and in the community. And so if you're having trouble in multiple domains of your life, completing tasks as required of you within those domains, for our kids, it's going to be kind of similar, except instead of work, it'd be school. So if they're having troubles and at home, at school, and in the community, then we would probably say that their anxiety is a little more severe than just kind of regular anxiety that someone might feel from day to day.
Jacek, you just finished a study at the Kinsey Institute's Traumatic Stress Research Consortium on this. What was the goal of the study?
The goal was to look at rates of anxiety, PTSD-type symptoms, and worry about the pandemic, now in a representative U.S. sample of adults. And what we found was that the amount of anxiety and some PTSD symptoms, like hypervigilance, related very strongly to the amount of worry that people had about different risks associated with the pandemic on their health, on their economic stability.
What did you find out in the study?
So what we found out was that all of these are highly correlated, but also one thing that we study in our group is the way that we broadly react to threats. So there are two types of threat reactions that are pretty common. These are broad classes, where one is a fight-flight mobilization. So this is a type of reaction that we can experience as jitteriness, irritability, restlessness, or anxiety. And this is a type of reaction that where we are mobilized to meet a challenge. And the other type is the shutdown, which includes chronic tiredness, a feeling of numbness, loss of interest or motivation. And people may experience both, or they may alternate between these states. And one thing is that over time, as we experience different types of stressors, our nervous systems may get tuned to react differently, where we see some individual differences and how likely we are to experience these things. And what we found is that people who had prior experience with adversities, maltreatment in their childhood, the loss of people close to them, they were more likely to experience worry related to the pandemic, and they were more likely to have symptoms of anxiety and these PTSD-type symptoms, and these were related to their physical body sensations as well. So one thing that happens when we respond to stress is that both the brain and the body are integrated to respond. And so when we're reacting to stress, that puts that changes the way that our body is regulated, that its typical functions, like its gastrointestinal function, work. And so people were sensing these disruptions physically as well.
Beth Trammell, is human contact and human interaction a balm for certain kinds of anxiety? And with the lack of that now with the pandemic and all of us staying away from each other, is that exacerbated?
Yeah, you know, I think being around people that we're close to can really help kind of minimize some of our anxiety, but also it can, you know, kind of protect us in some ways. And I think some things that I've seen happening as well is, you know, the lack of face-to-face communication means we're increasing our text or even phone call communication with others, and mostly text communication, which can be misinterpreted easily, right? And so we often rely on the face-to-face interactions, especially when we're anxious. We rely on face-to-face interactions to kind of ease some of our anxiety we might have about something someone said in a text to us. When we see them, we're like, oh, okay, we're friends again, and it's fine. And so I think in some ways, the lack of connection to people, particularly those who are just a little bit prone to anxiety, is likely to exacerbate it.
Be mindful of your text etiquette, to be sure. We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about mental health during the pandemic. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. And it's Matt again. We'll get back to today's Encore presentation shortly. But I wanted to tell you about a show we did last Thursday. We looked at the prevalence of conspiracy theories and misinformation around the pandemic. It was a great show, and you can hear it in our podcast feed wherever you get podcasts. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. Hey, it's Matt. A quick note, today's show originally aired last month, so we can't take your questions and comments for our panel, but feel free to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can let us know what you think of the show and share suggestions on what you'd like us to cover sometime. Again, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about mental health and how people can understand and address the issues they're having during the pandemic. And on the panel today is Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at IU, Edward Hirt. We also have Jacek Kolacz, Assistant Research Scientist at the Kinsey Institute Traumatic Stress Research Consortium at IU. Beth Trammell is Associate Professor of Psychology at Indiana University. And Katie Stanton-Nicholas is Associate Professor in the Department of Kinesiology at IUPUI. Beth Trammell, so you look at how kids and families are affected by situations like this. How much do we know about how kids are impacted? Is there good research on it?
Well, we don't have a lot of good research just yet, but I think we're going to be seeing more of it coming. We know that particularly our adolescents are feeling a little bit more of the anxiety related to this, but we're still early in the process of gathering research on how it's going to impact us both short-term and long-term.
What do we know about the adolescent brain that might make them more prone to that kind of anxiety?
Well, you know, I think part of it is that we are pushing them to be social beings, and so much of their brain development involves the impact of their peers. And so when we have kind of eliminated a lot of that connection with their peers, we have also kind of halted a little bit of those social connections that they're used to making And, you know, adolescence can be a really, can be a hard time for a lot of kids. And so when things are in total upheaval, it just makes an already kind of hard time even harder for them.
Adolescence was terrible for me. I remember it vividly, as it was for so many people. What kinds of challenges are parents facing during these last few months trying to help their kids through it?
Yeah, so I think I hear a lot of parents wondering, how am I supposed to help my kid cope through this? And how do I know if they're not doing well? Because not all our kids will actually tell us that.
Mm.
And so I talk a lot about communication strategies for parents. So sit down with your child and talk to them about some of the concerns you have, or kind of give them permission to have those concerns. So maybe you sit down and say, hey, you know, how are you feeling about having to wear masks? Or how do you feel about seeing other people wearing masks? Sometimes sharing some of the concerns you hear from other people and kind of checking in with your own child to see how they're feeling gives them the permission to then come and say, you know, I'm actually not worried about masks, but what I am worried about is seeing this new friend again that I haven't seen in a while. And when I have parents who wonder, are they really doing okay or are they just faking it? I usually say if kids start reverting to younger like behaviors, or they're having kind of meltdowns when they usually don't have meltdowns anymore, right? Any kind of major changes in their behavior, they're having problems sleeping, they're having problems eating, they're crying or they're withdrawing more, that might be a sign for you to check in with them. And if they're not really connecting with you, you might even ask them, hey, do you think you want to maybe go and talk to someone like a therapist or counselor?
Your timing talking about children and parents couldn't be more perfect. We have a listener comment from Megan on Facebook. She says, how do we help young children cope with all the stress and anxiety from reopening schools? With elementary ages, the kids may not really know much except that there's a sickness out there. Masks can be scary. Teachers not being able to touch them or give them a smile to let them know they're okay can be scary. How can we help the kids manage this time? What red flags should we look for in our kids' behavior that might let us know they're being affected? Anything, Beth?
Yeah, so I think even just having a conversation to prepare them in advance, say, hey, you know, you're going to go back to school and it's not going to be the way it was. Your teacher is going to be wearing a mask, and let's practice wearing your mask at home for a little bit. And what does it look like? How can you read my face? Can you tell that I'm smiling? You know, there are some ways that we can kind of prepare them by practicing a little bit and letting them know that just because, you know, their teacher isn't able to give them a hug, how else could they reach out for affection from their teacher if they're not feeling okay? So you might tell your child, hey, you know, your teacher may not be able to give you a hug this year, or, you know, at least for the first little while here, we don't know. But if you're feeling sad, what else makes you feel better? Maybe we can talk with Mrs. Smith about how you like when she says that you're doing a good job, or when she writes a note to you. If you can prepare them by giving them some other examples and kind of brainstorming, and then you can share that information with the teacher, it might ease some of the concerns going in.
Great advice. Thanks for that. Katie, can you talk about your area of expertise and how it relates to these issues that we're talking about today?
Sure. So my role in the Department of Case Kinesiology at IUPUI is really with regard to physical activity exercise for people with disabilities. But certainly when you think about exercise and physical activity, you think about it for everybody and not just for one population. So when we think about things that are happening now and how it's changed people's lives, we certainly consider the importance of physical activity and exercise for managing stress and anxiety. It's an interesting science, and we unfortunately have the assumption that if you just get out and move, it reduces your anxiety and stress, and that's actually not the case for everybody. I think it's also important to recognize there's a difference between physical activity, which is really just movement, period, and for kids in particular, it might just be play, whereas exercise tends to be more planned and structured, and its effect for the body are related to the intensity of the exercise, the frequency of the exercise, and how long you exercise. And so sometimes exercise can be more stress-inducing than it can be stress relief, whereas physical activity tends to be much more related to reduction in stress and anxiety, and then particularly for children. So for us right now, those of us who specialize in movement, for me particularly movement for children and families with disabilities, we really think about the loss of just general ability to play and move, particularly with peers or their same age non-disabled peers, and the change related to one-on-one interaction or group interaction, and then trying to interact with somebody on the screen and still move, and how that can impact families and children.
Edward Hertz, you've also looked into the connections between physical activity and mental health. How are they connected? How does that work?
Yeah, I agree with the panelists so far. I mean, in the sense that we tend to think that one of the really nice things that we can do is to keep active and to keep busy and have some routines and stuff. So when you think of from adult perspective, I mean, us having exercise and being able to continue that. We all have colleagues that, you know, I mean, are very, you know, used to having things a certain way, and that they find that this is certainly a big part of their life and makes them feel good, the endorphin kicks and everything that they get with it. And so, you know, if you can't do it the way you did it before, can you find appropriate substitutes? So many of us can still be outside, and if you run or if you just go for walks, whether it's alone or with your pets or whatever, I mean, these can be opportunities for us to still get out and to sort of feel active and have positive kind of experiences that we feel, you know, are good for us. So we know that that is certainly something that for many people is, as we know, I mean, something that gives us a sense of control, gives us a sense of being able to do things that we feel good, it gets us out and gets us distracted from some of the other concerns that we're having, and has that positive sense. Yes, we may not be able to do things exactly the way we did it before, and that can be stressful for us. That can be, you know, irritating for us. But I think, you know, the resilience that people have shown in being able to do things and come up with novel ways of enjoying the same kinds of things can be really interesting. I have a number of friends that are runners who are, you know, like to do, you know, these 5K events or half marathons or other kinds of things. And so they've been able to come up with virtual races and have people have alternate ways to be able to do this and still have some kind of challenge and still have something that they can share with other people on social media. They're not out doing it in a big collective group or whatever, but still to have some of the same kinds of aspects of that that for many people are rewarding and keep them involved and give them something to strive for and give them, again, some sense of control. So I think there are many creative ways that we've been able to use those kinds of things in a positive way to help people at least feel with some semblance of normalcy in their lives on that venture.
We're talking about anxiety and depression and the ways that the pandemic has brought on anxiety and depression or exacerbated it. And we have a big panel of experts with us today. And we have a listener comment from Hugh on Facebook who says, I'm wondering what impact COVID-19 has had on suicide and suicide attempt rates in Indiana. Does anyone on the panel have any information on that? If not numbers, then maybe insight? Beth, perhaps?
You know, I was trying to think about that question. I don't know from a numbers standpoint. And so I think as we're all talking here and the impact that that COVID has had on all of our mental health, I would imagine that we would see some increases in numbers, but I honestly don't know. I know that we were seeing some increase in alcohol use, but I'm not sure that that has translated into anything that I have seen.
Jacek, what are some of the challenges behind studying mental health, especially when using surveys? I mean, it seems like getting accurate data on something like this wouldn't necessarily be easy that way.
Right. And that's one of the difficulties of just conducting research during the pandemic, is that a lot of it has to be online, and a lot of the online measures that are available to us are self-reports. So the importance of having validated surveys that are that align with clinician reports and with clinician or specialist diagnoses are really important. There is only, you know, so much that they can tell us. However, the one benefit of this type of research is that we don't need people to come into an office or to a university laboratory. And so it does open up us up to possibly more representative samples in some ways.
What are you hoping to look into next, Jacek?
Right. So our next project is a longitudinal study. We'll be tracking trajectories of mental health in a national representative sample of 600 U.S. residents over several months. And we'll be looking at what are the individual trajectories, you know, what predicts who has more mental health challenges at this point, and also how they manage those mental health challenges, how they cope, and just seeing how this is going to play out in real time as the pandemic continues.
Is the pandemic a variable that you anticipate you're going to be looking at for a long, long time?
I think so. I think so. One of the things is, you know, our research right now is open-ended. We don't know what to expect, what to plan for a month or two from now. And so we're certainly playing it by ear and trying to adjust our research to what is happening nationally to be able to react to these events that we can't predict as researchers.
Katie, my wife and I have had a number of spirited conversations, I guess would be a word, in trying to decide what piece of exercise equipment we should buy soon, because the pandemic we've been eating a lot more, and I can't say that we've been gaining weight, but we've been not feeling great about it. And of course, I think we've decided, and it's not important right now. But have you found that this is making some of us stir crazy, and that we feel this need, this drive to be physically active on a scale that we weren't before?
Oh, I mean, anecdotally, yes, for sure. I mean, much like was mentioned before, what we're learning about people's need to move, we've known for a long time the benefits of movement in terms of decreasing tension and stabilizing mood, how it can reduce anxiety, and it can also be tied positively to somebody's self-esteem or belief in one's body's efficacy, the ability to do things. And so, when you think about all your life changing, and perhaps you were participating regularly in a class, you had a gym membership or whatever, and those were really important triggers in your life to get to. I always think about exercise as kind of your body itches to move. It needs to move sometimes, and so that can feel like anxiety for people, and that need to move is, I would tell you, and I wouldn't worry about the equipment that you order necessarily, as long as it gets yourself moving. Because if people really pay attention to their body, it will tell them a lot. And I mean that both physiologically and sociologically and mentally. Your body is a really healthy trigger for being able to not only take care of your mental health, but your physical health. So if you're sitting and you feel achy, get up and move. And that's why I talked a little bit about the difference between physical activity and exercise, because just taking a walk up and down your driveway, while it may not raise your heart rate and necessarily provide you with any cardiorespiratory benefit at that moment, it can greatly reduce your mental stress. It might provide you some different insights. You might tag along that with your music or something so you get a chance, or do some breathing exercises. So when you are told these are your boundaries, and those boundaries include physical limitations. This is where we want you to go, or these are places that you might need to avoid. Your body certainly will respond to that, especially if a way of expressing health for you is vigorous physical activity. So I can tell you from my personal standpoint, and certainly the people around me can tell you, that if I don't move, I'm not a particularly fun person to be around. So it is necessary to move your body. And so if people are feeling that way, then they should move. The contrary to that, and not to say movement is bad, but to recognize when you're using exercise as a way to control mental health in a negative way. So we also have a group of people who sometimes will abuse exercise as a way to feel like they're controlling things around them rather than use it as a healthy form of mental health expression. So I think it's important to look at both sides of things and recognize that in general we say move, do it. But recognize when you might need something else in addition to help support your overall mental health.
There's a lot more to talk about. We'll keep the conversation going after a quick break. We're talking to a live panel of experts about anxiety, depression, and other mental health issues being caused or amplified by the pandemic. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on anxiety and depression and other mental health issues people are facing during the pandemic. And one final note, today's show is an encore of a show we aired last month, so we can't take your questions and comments for our panel. But feel free to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana for discussion and topic alerts. When we originally aired this show, we began this segment with a listener voicemail from Joseph. Let's hear that now.
Yes, my name is Joseph from Indianapolis. I am a licensed psychotherapist. And one thing I have not heard discussed is the differences with regards to persons of color. Black and brown people express their anxiety and depression in different ways. They have to be treated by individuals that are culturally competent to treat them. So I don't hear that addressed at all. I don't know if any of your panel are from Black and brown community, but that's particularly stressful on individuals in that community.
Thank you very much, Joseph, for your voicemail. Edward Hertz or Beth Trammell, any answer for Joseph?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can resonate to his concerns, because I think that we certainly feel like, you know, there is not a one-size-fits-all kind of ability for people to comment and help others, you know, get through these different kinds of things. And we've already talked about some differences that exist in people and how they do it. But obviously, there's so many different kinds of, as you said, he acknowledged cultural kinds of factors as well. I mean, in terms of how people are dealing with this, obviously, there's lots of things in the news that are particularly concerned with that community in terms of their susceptibility to potentially the illness, and in terms of all the other things going on with the corresponding protests, et cetera, as well as it's just the question of being able to understand people's life circumstances in a way of how they cope with anxiety, what kinds of tools are available to them to be able to cope with it. And so we have to be sensitive to the fact that, you know, there is not a one size fits all kind of prescription that we can give somebody that's going to apply equally to everybody, and just be sensitive to those factors for sure.
Beth Trammell, we talked a little bit about discussing the pandemic with children earlier. These conversations that parents can have with their kids, they've got to be pretty different depending on the age of the child. What would you say to a parent with young children, maybe someone like me? I have a 3-year-old. What would you say to those parents who might be worried that they're too young to understand it?
Yeah. And, you know, some of our young kids really are too young to understand it. And so at the heart of what we want, of what the message needs to be, is safety, right? Both physical and emotional safety. We want our little guys to just realize that, you know, we are doing our best to be safe. We're doing our best to keep other people safe. You can talk about it from a standpoint of
of sickness or not being well, and this is why we can't go here, because we want to keep everybody safe and we can't share our germs with other people. And so as we're trying to continue conversations, whether it's about masks or not masks, why we can't go here or we can't go there, why we can't start school or we're going to start school in a certain way, I think it's just kind of those continued messages of this is what we're doing, you're safe, we're keeping our germs to ourselves, and kind of center it around safety.
Katie Stanton-Nicholas, you also look at young people and how parents can help children with disabilities navigate a situation like this. What are the unique challenges coming up right now?
Well, I think that one of the things that you have to recognize is when a parent or when families have a child with a disability, the generalized factors that increase stress are a little bit different. Most of the work that's done research-wise looks at level of income, time, social supports being better predictors of stress than the actual disability of the child, e.g., whether it's social, physical, or intellectual. And so you can then imagine when you have a pandemic like COVID and people are out of work or their income has been reduced, time is, while it seems ever-present because most of us are at home, just the mere schedule change for a lot of kids with disabilities can be really, really difficult. And then a reduction of social supports can go along with income, can go along with time. And so one of the concerns that our community has, particularly for families with disabilities, is not only how do you address support for the children, but we know there's a relationship between how well families cope to how well children cope. So you want to make sure both ends of the continuum are being cared for. And so what we're hearing mostly from our families right now is sameness, trying to keep the environment same for their child, which of course you could argue that for any family a little bit right now, but for kids with disabilities, so much about their lives is around schedule. And so when we stopped going to school, how do we create a new schedule for that child? And then what does that look like in relationship to the family's ability to cope in terms of whether they're at home or at work? And then, you know, a lot of children with disabilities have multiple caregivers during a school day. So they might have their teacher, their primary teacher, but they might also have a physical or occupational or speech therapist with them, or a research teacher or an aide that works with them. And so who are those individuals and where have they gone, trying to kind of explain that to kids. And so it is, I would argue, has been very, very hard on all families with children, but in particular, families who have kids with disabilities have an additional stress that kind of layers over the normal stress, that when you take away some of the supports that are normally there offered through public school and federal mandates, some of those things have been certainly additional stressors for those families as well.
We have another voicemail. Oh, go right ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, so again, I would go back to this idea of movement and physical activity and play, because it can be a really good cathartic thing for a family in general, but it also creates a normalized routine for kids so they can get a little bit of energy out so they can come back in and be a little bit more engaging afterwards.
Thank you for that. We have another listener voicemail. Let's hear that now.
Hi. I recently had a breakup, and I think largely due to COVID and too much togetherness, and it's been tough. And I was wondering what, if you have any suggestions on how we can get through this individually and then together and not hate each other.
Sorry to hear about that. Beth Trammell, any advice for our listener?
Yeah, I think, you know, to the listener's point, sometimes too much togetherness isn't necessarily the best thing for all relationships. So I think, like any breakup, I think it's first realizing how to take care of yourself well first. And so that may mean kind of working through the grieving process of the relationship, making sure you're using healthy coping strategies and not unhealthy coping strategies, like using substances or overeating or any of those unhealthy ways of coping. But I often talk with folks about reaching out for some therapy. Right now, there are a lot of great counselors who are doing a lot of great work virtually. Interestingly, COVID has kind of pushed a lot of therapists into learning some new skills of meeting the needs of folks in a different way. And so connecting with a therapist so that we can take care of ourselves first and then decide whether now that we're starting to get back into kind of normal life, whatever that kind of looks like, realizing whether the relationship is something that you should go back to or kind of move on from.
And I am not an expert by any means, but I've been through some big breakups and even one divorce. And to the point, some of the points that were raised earlier in the conversation, physical activity, especially enjoyable physical activity, like physical activity outdoors, was a saving grace for me when I was going through those times, for what it's worth. We have another listener voicemail. This one is from John. Let's listen.
This is John of Brookston. And the thing I was asking on this problem with the virus, what I call displaced aggression phenomena, which has caused a lot of people to be extremely violent at some of these protests. Has it anything to do with that problem? I hope I phrased it correctly. Displaced aggression. Thank you.
Edward Hurt, do we know anything about what John's suggesting?
Yeah, he's absolutely got a stinker on something that we have been concerned about. You asked a while back about the suicide rate and the issues of, you know, people doing things to themselves that are negative in this situation with anxiety. But we know that in many, many situations when people are frustrated and anxious and feeling upset, I mean, they lash out at others. So one of the things that, you know, the previous caller was talking about in terms of whether the breakup was initiated by this, sometimes when people are on top of each other and they're, you know, and they're not used to spending so much time together, or there's all these other frustrations with financial difficulties and other uncertainties and stuff, we do take, you know, lash out at other people, and they could be the people in our houses, or they could be people who are doing things that we disagree with or think are wrong. And so certainly we've been seeing some instances of people being really hyper responsive to different things when people challenge them, whether we think of it as sort of like the road rage phenomenon when people are out driving and they're frustrated and they may take it out. But I'm sure he's alluding to some of these things where, like, people are running into protesters and they're, you know, doing things that just seem so incredibly, you know, violent and, you know, overreacting to simple things of disagreements or people doing something that we think is just not something we agree with. So this is definitely something that we are really concerned about, because as this pandemic continues and people continue to have these frustrations, they do tend to build on each other. And, you know, it does breed that situation where people could potentially lash out at, again, those that are right around them or people that they encounter in just everyday life situations, where they can kind of take out, as you said, displace and take out their aggressions on other people that are not really the cause of where, you know, these frustrations and insecurities and anxieties really are from.
Jacek Kolacz, I want to make sure that we get this definition out and in front of people. And this seems like a very basic question, but not everybody knows the answer. Jacek, what is depression?
What is depression? Well, depression is a cluster of symptoms that have to do with a response to stress, often, that gets the body into preparing for shutdown. So it's something that we see not just in humans, but across the animal kingdom, where it's a pretty common reaction to prepare the body to go limp, go numb, stop activity. So that kind of reaction is something that can lead to that cluster of symptoms that is categorized as depression.
And thank you for that. So along those lines, and to follow up, I guess, do you think that enough people right now understand exactly what depression is, especially to the degree that they can identify symptoms when they experience them?
Right. So I think this is a very good point. And one thing that you've mentioned is a lot, some of the people might be feeling these things for the first time. One of the things that's tricky is that our stress responses are mediated by these low-level brain regions like the brainstem. And so we can we're not often aware of what's causing our feelings, or we may not even notice some of the symptoms, especially if we're not used to checking for them. So one thing that's really important to do for people right now is to, as was mentioned before, just check in with where your mood is, where your energy level is, how your body is feeling. All of these can tell the story of how your body and your brain are reacting to the stressful situation.
In your recent study, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, you talked about, or you looked rather, at how prior trauma impacts new threats and the responses to them. Can you explain then how trauma is defined in this context?
Right. So there are a lot of definitions of trauma out there. I think one that I found very useful in thinking about what defines trauma is that it's the body and brain's reaction. So people can have the same experience or the same thing that happens to them, but their experience of that event can be very different. And some people might walk away from an experience and say, that didn't faze me at all, or maybe it was even invigorating. Other people can walk away and say, that felt very traumatic. And the important thing is that response and understanding your experience of that situation.
What are some of the most common sources of trauma that affect people in situations like this?
So there are a number of domains that people are experiencing stress in right now. Some have to do with risk of infection. Some have to do with economic stability. Some have to do with worry about family members or being separated from the people that help you feel safe. And so for different people, there are going to be different aspects of these domains that come to the forefront. All of these can impact our stress responses, can lead to experiences of anxiety and depression.
Edward Hurt, if anxiety is about a lack of control for a lot of people, and the pandemic has introduced a lot of new things we can't control, is it helpful to try to find things we can control to help manage anxiety? How much of a difference would that make?
A lot. That's a very insightful comment. I mean, I think that one of the things we're searching for is something that we can hold on to that makes us feel like, you know, we can sort of sit back on something and trust that something is going to be as predictable as we hope it can be. And so I think anything that people can do to be able to sort of feel that sense of control, whether it's, you know, bonding with other people, whether it's physical activity, whether it's just giving yourself some time to be able to do something that gives you some kind of pleasure and enjoyment that just gives you a sense of, you know, knowing that I can rely on this and that this is something predictable. I think we really need to do those kind of things because it's so easy to get wrapped up in so much of the uncertainty and, you know, just inability to predict what's going to happen in the future that those things would be really, really good for us to keep in mind.
I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Edward Hurt is professor of psychological and brain sciences at IU. Jacek Kolacz is assistant research scientist at the Kinsey Institute Traumatic Stress Research Consortium at Indiana University. Beth Trammell is associate professor of psychology at Indiana University. Katie Stanton-Nicholas is associate professor in the Department of Kinesiology at IUPUI. And I am Matt Pelser. Thank you so much for listening this hour. This is All In.